First, we're going to talk about the administrative priorities at Northeastern. With the, you know, what's the old saying that you can tell people's priorities where they spend their money? So we're going to take a look at where the money's going. And then we're going to talk a bit about the AAUP censure process and a case that's pending here at Northeastern. And then Russell Benjamin will be arriving shortly to share with us a bit about shared governance. He's currently the president of the Faculty Senate and, of course, has something to say about shared governance. So we'll start with the money, guns, and lawyers, right? And when we look at the audited financial statements of the university, these are have been required since 2002, right? Before 2002, universities were not required to do these audited financial statements. They just did their budgets, and then it was a mystery where the money was actually spent. Because as we know, the budget includes a lot of spending that never happens. You'll see if you go look at the budget, names and salaries of people who are retired, but their budget line is still there. So that money, where does it go, right? It and a lot of other money goes into what's called the net financial assets, right? And this, in a corporate view, would be the profits. The money that's left over after they've taken in money from students, the state, and the federal government, and then spent money on the educational enterprise, right, which is the main goal of any university, then what they have left over is are these net financial assets. And again, these have been now audited since 2002, and we can see the huge rise in net financial assets on the campus, right? We are putting away money at an enormous rate, and according to these audited financial statements, between 2002 and 2012, we have increased net financial assets by 77.73%. That's a massive increase of cash that's being stashed by this university. In 2002, they had just over $81 million in reserve, right? This is, again, where then that net financial assets is put into reserve. This is a big slush fund of cash. By 2012, it had grown to over $144 million, right? The current year's numbers are not available yet. The review of numbers have been done. The audit is being done. In the next, I think it's usually around March to July that the financial statements are available for public view. But we don't have them yet for this past year. But as you can see, the university has a ton of cash sitting there. And the question, right, for those of us concerned about education is why, right? Why is this money sitting there? Especially during these tough financial times, we're constantly told to tighten our belts, do more with less, cut classes, all of that. Why do we need all of this cash sitting there? Yeah.
Am I right that our annual operating budget is usually about $80 million?
I think that's about right, yeah.
And the rule is that they have 110 days of operating budget in reserve?
Yeah. This is far exceeds that. And this is not unique to Northeastern, right? I went to a workshop last summer that the AUP put on. There was like literally a three-day workshop on how to analyze this data. And this is a national trend, right? The universities are behaving more like corporations than public service institutions in stashing all of this cash away and feeling the pressure to take in this extra cash. Because in a perfect world, they should spend every dollar they bring in. You know, maybe a little reserve for, you know, an emergency or something, but we should be spending the dollars because we get, all the dollars we get are for educational purposes. They're not for building reserve.
Is this reserve independent of the 110 days they have to have by law?
Is it independent of that? I don't know. I don't see in the audited financial statement a separate one for that legal reserve. There are lots of different pots of money, but there was no discussion about whether this was is separate or the same in the training that I had. This is just money they've had. And again, you can see, especially in a period of austerity, to be taking in this kind of money at this huge increase is something to be concerned about, I think. Another thing that I came across looking at the budgets, and again, these are the budgets. This is projected spending. This is what they plan to spend. The audited financial statement is what they did spend. When we look at the university police, this is one of the areas in the budget that has grown the most dramatically since 2002. That number one there is 2002, number two is 2007, and then three is 2012. It took 5-year periods there. And the numbers that go with that, right, are between 2002 and 2012, the University of Police, they used to be called Public Safety, then they became University of Police. Their budget grew by 137.79%, so more than doubled plus almost 40%. And they added 8 full-time police to their ranks during this period. And I didn't count the safety officers, the people that do the telecommunications. I only counted what are called, you know, police officers, the ones that carry guns and badges. And they've added 8 of those during that period. And remember that number when we get to the faculty in a minute. They're also spending a ton of money on lawyers or hoarding a lot of money. I'm not sure, right? Legal support is the blue line, and then university counsel is the red line. And according, again, to the budgets, legal support, and that's spending on outside counsel, increased by 167%, again, doubled plus two-thirds increase between 2002 and 2012. They were spending $156,800 in 2002. Now they're spending $420,000 a year, again, on outside counsel, lawyers from outside the university. So if we add all that money up for those 10 years, they've either spent or hoarded, we're not sure, $2.8 million on this line alone. Okay, that's a ton of money. Meanwhile, in-house counsel salaries have more than doubled. We've got one in-house counsel, and between 2005 and 2012, that salary went from $54,000 to $125,000. Okay, so the in-house counsel is also receiving a lot more salary than in 2005. And again, this is a period of austerity where the rest of us have been told, you know, your class might not make it, you might not get paid. And meanwhile, when we look at student, faculty, and staff, we see that our priorities are being terribly left behind. I'm going to start with looking at what's happening to the students. If you look at blue on this graph, right, that's the student portion of income. And again, the first little pie is 2002, the one in the middle is 2007, the last pie is 2012. And in 2002, students were paying about 19% of the portion of income that the university received for their education. The state was paying 37%, and the federal government was paying 21%. Now, that has totally turned around. It looks like you just took that pie and turned it around. Now the students are paying 34%, the state is only paying 19%, and the federal government only 14%, right, of the total money coming in from those three sources. So the president likes to say that we're, you know, a state-assisted institution, right? And as far as the money goes, that's true, right? It's state-assisted and student-funded. The students are bearing the burden of the cost of the education here. Enrollment is another thing that people are very concerned about, right? So I looked at two different sets of data, and this is from the NEIU.edu, the institutional research people. And here we're looking from 2002 to 2013, and these are all fall numbers, right? And you see there's, you know, increasing and then a drop-off and then increasing and drop-off in enrollment. You see a similar thing with total credit hours, you know, a couple of humps there. They're a little bit skewed more so than the others. And then when we put them together, we see a more flattened picture. And if we look at the numbers, we see that actually credit hours, right? And this, I think, has to do with the different kinds of students we're having. Students are taking more hours. We've got fewer students, but they're taking more hours each. Again, the economy's bad. They don't have work outside. So enrollment has fallen more than credit hours have. Right, so we're losing more students, and those that remain are taking more hours. Credit hours have increased between 2002 and 2012 by 4.4%. But in 2013, there was a drop of 1.3%. Excuse me, 2013. That's this last fall. Anybody got a guess why that big drop happened? Yeah, we lost a lot of classes. Imagine that. You don't offer classes, students don't have credit hours. Yeah.
Can I call that enrollment suppression?
Yeah, that'd be a good name for it, enrollment suppression. Yeah, very good. Very good. Yeah, let's use that term. Enrollment increased by 2.1% between 2002 and 2007 and then dropped between 2007 by 2.3% in 2007, and then by 5.5% when you compare 2013 and 2007 back to 2002, right? So again, we were sort of going up in numbers and then down. And this is, of course, not good that we're losing bodies, but what really drives the place, right, is credit hours. So when you even those out, it wouldn't be a horrible thing, right, to have fewer students taking more hours because we'd still have as many classes to offer. The university would be taking in as many dollars. There's be as many need for classes and so forth. So better this way than the other way, right? More students taking fewer hours would be a bigger problem for us financially. But, of course, the only drop that we had over the last 10 years in enrollment and credit hours was this semester. And we all know what happened this semester. Now, when we look at the faculty, between 2002 and 2012, the tenure-track faculty grew by 1.89%, which is actually five faculty, right? When you subtract out those that retired, add in those that are hired, we grew by five tenure-track faculty. Remember how many cops we added in that period? Eight. Right, so where are the priorities here? Non-tenure track faculty grew by 40% in that period, and part-time instructors grew by 20% in that period, right? So again, the full-time faculty are not growing. 1.89% is less growth than we had in credit hours, and we're in credit hours of 4.4% growth. So the administration is not investing in tenure track faculty, sort of the long-term needs of the institution, and instead hiring people that can be easily dismissed. Now, when we take a look at the administration, they have increased their employment numbers by 22.5%. They're 22.5% more people called executive administrators on this campus over the last 10 years. And then other professional slash support is also up 43.8%. This is where the growth in employment is on the campus.
What does that include?
The iPads is where I got this, and they don't break it out. But my guess, looking at the other categories, is that the executive administration are like VPs, and so because we've had a plethora of those come in, and assistant VPs, and then the other professional support are directors and people in that area, maybe even assistant and associate deans, because we've had a ton of those added in the last 10 years as well. Mm-hmm. They don't break it out in the iPads data. A&P positions, right, those kinds of things is my guess. Because, again, the technical and paraprofessionals are down 11%. Right? At a time when the university claims to be, you know, catching up and so forth, the tech people are down 11%. The clerical staff are down 12%. Skilled craft are down 22.5%. And service and maintenance are flat. Right? So the people that actually do the daily work, the things we need done and so forth are declining fairly rapidly, and then those that make the highest salaries and are the least accessible to most of us are increasing quite dramatically. So that's sort of the financial, the numbers part. That's the dry part. And so if there are questions about that, I'd be happy to take those before we move into the...
Anyone talk to the president about this huge increase, and does she have anything to say about it?
I think Dr. Libretti tried to have that conversation, am I right? Talking to the president about the increase?
Different kinds of accounting, but the... Yeah. And I think there was another question about whether there was surpluses at the end of the year that were going into reserve above and beyond. Because I believe they budget a certain amount to go into reserve responsibly. Because they have to have, by law, they have to have, I believe, a minimum of 110 days operating budget in reserves.
It'd be about $30 million, I would guess. Yeah.
They have to put in their initial budget every year, and the amount that's going to go to reserves. So the question was something like, it suggested that there was a manufacturing crisis on campus, and then asked if, it also said something about these reserves, why is more money going to reserves than the end of the year? And she kind of suggested that wasn't true. And she also made the statement at the end that, maybe in response to that question, that the amount they do have in reserves is supposedly by some audit, whether by state state measures or not, they consider very modest. Again, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if she has a different way of counting.
I'm sorry, what was that?
She stated that by some measure, I think state measure, or I don't know who does the measure, but that our reserves were determined to be very modest. I will say I'm on the faculty council, or faculty committee on finance and administration, which I've been on for 2 years and I couldn't get us to meet last year. No.
Nice.
We did finally meet this year. And I was asking some questions, and Mark Wilcoxon was trying to lay out, I believe, in good faith, very transparently, sort of projects underway. And he was talking about the College of Ed building and dorms. And he mentioned that in order to, when they build the College of Ed building, they're going to have to build a utility plant for the South Campus, which we don't have now. So the lights go out, like the gym is never on a generator, for example. Everything's just shut down. And I said, oh, is that going to be part of the allocation we're getting from the state for the building? He said, no, we have to pay for that. I said, well, how much does that cost? And he said, $8 to $10 million. I said, and where do we get that money? And he said, reserves. And he said, with that and sort of dorms, that they've been planning for this for a long time. Mm-hmm. So they've been putting money in reserves. So this is one explanation. And others have told me that, you know, priority is buildings. And if you saw the president either in the State of the Union University address or the town hall address, she put up that map of all the like child care building and the number of buildings. So I'm not trying to make a judgment right now. I'm just trying to explain why they're building up these reserves. What is a little unnerving to me and disappointing is that at the town hall, when she was asked about buildings, Nancy Wrinkle, our good colleague, asked a question. And she said, well, look at the funding. And there seemed to be an explanation that everything's funded by the state, with the education building and some other thing they were talking about. So I'm not sure why they just can't be transparency coming out of putting all this money in reserves because of the buildings, if that's what's going on. I'd like to. I mean, maybe the community can get on board with that, or whatever. I don't know, but I'm not sure why there seems to be. Because Mark Wilcoxon was very forthright. I mean, it wasn't a secret. I'm not sure why the president isn't saying that in these explanations. And maybe some oversight. I don't know. So I mean, it doesn't seem to be a secret in the sense that Mark Wilcoxon is very forthcoming about the projects underway and their money being spent.
Right, and I think that's a good point, right? If they have plans for this money, we should know about it, and we should have some say in it. Again, we're supposed to be a university with shared governance, which means that faculty have input into the priorities and what's happening. And certainly those buildings will be funded by the state. They get the funding in advance, just like they did with the El Centro, just like they did with the Fine Arts Building, right? Those funds do come in and block sets of money. So they won't be building buildings with this.
Well, the El Centro money's coming out of reserve too. That money they didn't get from the state; they borrowed that money, right?
So right.
They're making their mortgage payments or whatever.
Right.
They can't.
Right. Right. And you would expect that if they were using it for buildings and things, you would occasionally see a huge takedown in reserves, and we don't see that. Okay, that's pretty steady and going up. And again, that it goes up in a period of austerity is what's particularly troubling, right? How do they get all this extra money when they're telling us they have none? And I don't know why the president wouldn't know about this. She receives those audited financial statements. I mean, if you look at them, they're over there in Dario's world, right? In the archives, and every one of them has the signature of the auditing firm that does the audit and the signature of the president when she receives the audit, because she has to acknowledge that she received it and understands any recommendations that were made in the audit, which occasionally there are. So the president should be well aware that this money is there. You know what's in your savings account, right? More or less. Yeah, a lot less than this, right? Yeah, Ellen, did you?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the policing aspect, because you and I talked about this a bit, just to share with everybody, because we had a union colleague who was actually working as a police officer during this increase that Loretta's pointed out, and he said a couple of things that, just to be aware of, that there are state policing standards, of course, and apparently until recently, the university has been understaffed according to those standards, right? But then what happened when the Virginia Tech shooting happened, they realized that they were woefully understaffed if anything like that were to happen here, and that's when they started ramping up, right? So.
Yeah, and I got in touch with the organization that sets those standards. They're not really any state standards that I could find or that this guy could tell me about, but this is like a professional organization that offers recommendations for staffing, just like the AUP offers recommendations for how many tenure-track faculty you should have in relation to non-tenure-track faculty, which is always ignored here. And the sort of formula that they use to decide how many police you need is very complex, so I didn't sit down and work it out. But I did look at other campuses to compare, and it seems to me that we have more than enough police because much of that formula that's used has to do with residential campuses. So, of course, when you've got dorms, you basically have a little city. One of the other criteria they look at is how far you are from a police station. We're like a mile, I think, from the one on Pulaski. And, of course, we always see Chicago police all over this campus. So we're not the same as, like, an isolated campus in a small town that can't support, like, I mean, we've all been at those university towns, right, where basically the university is the town. If they didn't have a policing agency, there wouldn't be one. We're not in that situation. We're right in the middle of a very over-policed city with plenty of police in the area. And so I think when we take those things into account, things might look a little differently. And then, of course, my major comparison is, well, if we're an educational institution, shouldn't we first be dealing with getting our percentage of tenure-track faculty in balance with what's recommended by other educational institutions and then deal with the policing if we need to. Yeah. Olivia, sorry.
On another note, can you, so a lot of times what administrators or even faculty will respond, how they'll respond when you bring up this gap and this, you know, rise in administrators in their numbers and their salaries, is that they'll just dismiss it and say different pot. And so can you explain that and how that, because we did this at the meeting, we explained how that doesn't.
Yeah, Olivia and I presented some of these same data at a recent meeting, and she's got a lot better theory on this than I have. She's she's the theorist. But the pot situation I can explain. There are multiple pots. But the pots that are highly restricted are very small and can easily be replaced, right? So it's sort of like if you have a pot of money in your household budget that's for paying the gas bill because it's going to go up, right? If you end up with not enough money in that pot, you can move it from somewhere else pretty easily in there. Or if you end up with too much money in that pot, you can easily move it out. And that is the situation with the vast majority of money that this campus holds. Like, that can be moved from pot to pot pretty easily. In the rare case that it is restricted funds, the things that it's restricted to are the primary needs of the campus, right? Educational and so forth. So that money is always spent first. And then all this extra money can easily be used any way they want. So there's really, and again, this was what was explained to me at the workshop by an accounting professor who's done many reports. He did one on UIC that was fantastic when they did their layoffs a few years ago. There really is no funds that are so restricted that they can't be used as the administration finds necessary. So that not a very good, yeah.
It's just, and this is coming from other ways that the administration has kind of interfaced between the budget and policy, is that they're using how they structure the budget in order to justify the policy.
Yeah.
So we can't do that because this money is in this spot.
Exactly.
And it's not that the money is in that spot because that's the only place it can be. It's that they put it there.
Right.
So they put the money there, and then that allows them to justify, this is our policy, and we can't change our policy because this is where the money is. It's in this budget line.
Exactly. It's
so, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a nice trick, right? That if you say, well, I don't have money to feed my kids this week because all my money's in my entertainment budget and I got to go to the movies, right? I mean, that's how ridiculous that is, because usually it is the primary needs of this institution that we're arguing for as faculty, right? It's like, we need more classes, we need more student support. Oh, no, we can't do that because the money's over here because I got to go take a trip to China and spend $20,000 having a good time. Can't be moving that around. Or I got to give myself a huge raise this year, and that's got to come out of somewhere, right? Yeah, these ideas of pot, you're right, they decide what pots to put it in and then use that as the excuse about why they can't meet the needs of the faculty and the students and the staff on the campus. Absolutely. Yeah.
I just want to make sure that we tell the best story possible, so I think we have to be conservative and make sure everything's right, so they can't say, well, you're wrong about this.
You know how conservative I am.
So here's a couple things. I don't have the answers, but one thing is with the police. I just want to worry because they're our brothers and sisters in blue. And they, a lot of them supported us during the strike. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to them during the strike, and a lot of them were really overworked. They were getting forced overtime, all kinds of stuff. And I don't know why that is, but that explains this injury, but I just want us to be careful about it. It's best to be careful about how we talk about them as labor, what's already going on there with that. That's one thing. And then with the reserves, it's an astounding story, so we have to make sure that it's told accurately, because I think we're right about this anyway. Because they will say, well, but the state doesn't make its payments. And that's pretty, it's not going to make up that deficit, but we need to make sure we, yes, even with you making up for the late payments by the state, and even with you having to have this 110-day operating budget, I just want to make sure we cover all those bases so that, as Olivia's pointing out, they don't find, well, you don't understand this.
Yeah.
You're very cute to be going through the budget, but
yeah.
Maybe that's how we get treated.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I've heard that line
and
directly.
It would be nice, too, if we understood, because when I talk to certain people, they say, well, yeah, but this is how they do their accounting, so they haven't technically lied. What are their accounting methods where they say that we have a surplus? Like, is there some method that's legally sanctioned that they're using? These are things I think it would behoove us to know when we address them.
Right. And the major issue there, right, is to know the difference between the budget and the audited financial statement, right? The budget is their plan. It's their putting money in pots and then claiming they can't move it, right? It's like when Chicago Public Schools claimed that they had a deficit based on their budget. And then the audited financial statements roll around and they've got a $2 billion surplus, right? Because they didn't spend that money where they said they were going to. And that's what this audited financial statement, that is the accounting standards, that is the legal one. The budget one is just what they make up, right? I'm sure in a very methodological, scientific way, they decide what all those numbers are. But they don't have to be real. There's no auditor coming in to check them. The audited financial statement, there is an auditing firm that comes in and looks through the numbers and comes up with, okay, you've got this $144 million extra money here. I didn't claim that. That's what the guy who, the auditor, the accountant is stating. This is how much you have in reserves. And they're getting praised for having all this great reserve money. Because, again, these are auditors who are accustomed to looking at corporations, and they want to see big reserves.
We have documentation of that praise when you say that they're being praised for that.
Yeah, it's in the, I think in the latest one. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I took it to the meeting with the provost when he just patted me on the head and said, oh, yeah, you're looking at, yeah, it's there. So, yeah, so those are the numbers. And so anybody who wants to look at some of this more carefully, I've got stuff that I can share with you. Just let me know. So the censure is the other thing we wanted to talk about today, because it is a very disheartening and unfortunate thing that has happened on the campus. But the university has been investigated by the national AAUP now because of a denial of tenure on campus a couple of years ago. I serve on the Illinois AAUP Committee A, and the Committee A is the committee that looks at problems with academic freedom and tenure. And we were given a case to review in the linguistics department of a gentleman who went up for tenure and was denied. And I'm going to read a little bit from our report because the national report is not yet public, but will be shortly. And so this is based on the above, where we went through all of the information gathered, which we believe to be accurate, complete, and fairly presented. We believe your, meaning the university administration, extraordinary refusal to accept Dr. Boyle's chair, department, dean, and UPC recommendation for granting of tenure is untenable. It violates Dr. Boyle's academic freedom and undermines share governance at Northeastern Illinois University. And then it goes through the statement of principles and so forth to be very clear about it. Many people in the room were part of the investigation over the summer, where three members of an investigating committee came into town, two from out of state, one from down at UIC, and reviewed the situation, met with the administration, heard what they had to say, met with faculty involved, heard what they had to say. They put together a report that has now been accepted by the National Committee A, and they have sent that out to the involved parties for response and have received response. And now they are working on the final draft of that report, which we expect to be out before the end of this term. If it's not out before the end of the term, they will hold on to it until January, because it's a very big deal when the AUP puts out a report like this. And so they do not want to put it out during a holiday break when the press will not be available, because it will be covered when it comes out. The Chronicle of Higher Ed will run a piece on it, Inside Higher Ed. All of the educational journalists will be very interested in this report and will be reporting on it. Now, the shameful thing of that is that the National Committee report, preliminary report that I did get a copy of and did get to read, is very consistent with what I just read to you. Far more expansive, obviously, 21 pages of documents. And my understanding of the response that they received from the administration is that it didn't change the report very much. They will be adding a few footnotes, a few quotes, perhaps putting the response as an appendix. But the report is going to make it very clear what happened on this campus, which many of us are quite aware of, which was a violation of the tenure process, a violation of academic freedom, and that will be made public. And then in the spring, when the Committee A meets again, if there hasn't been any move forward, the Committee A will take that report to the national meeting of the AUP in June, and there will very likely be a call for censure of the campus. Now, censure is not a place a university wants to be. Right? And again, nobody in this room, I don't think, wants this campus to be censured. What we want is for academic freedom to be respected, for tenure to be respected, and for policies to be followed fairly and evenly. And of course, we will be celebrating if that happens and we have our colleague back and everything moves along. If that doesn't happen, then I think we can all bemoan the fact that if the campus is censured, because this then puts the university on a list of very select few universities that have been censured in the past, which is basically a statement to the academic community at large that this campus does not respect academic freedom, it does not respect the tenure process, and it has to change to get off the list. Two of the investigators that came to campus work on campus that have been censured and have come off the censure list, right? And if you get censured, the first thing you want to do is get off that censure list. Because many of us belong to associations that when we put out job ads, if we are censured, if we put out a job ad, we will have to include in that job ad that this campus has been censured. And that will limit the quality and number of people who will be willing to take a job on this campus. I would not work at a campus that has been censured. Then you don't know if you're going to be treated fairly or not, and frankly, the campus has already been judged that they will not treat you fairly. Yeah, Tim?
Loretta, are there precedents for the AAUP making a tenure decision, delivering a censure, and having that have a real influence in leading?
There have been cases where the threat of involvement of the AUP has turned things around. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case here. There are campuses that take the AUP very seriously, and when they start looking at a case and saying, hey, we're going to come in and look at this thing, start looking at what happened and correct their actions before there's even an investigation. That has happened. It has happened where there's been an investigation, and then the administration took a close look, changed things around, and made things right. That does happen. And then also what happens is they don't change things. The campus is censured, and then there's a move to remove from censure, and usually what that takes is a removal of a president and a change in the administration that will then recognize and respect academic freedom and tenure. So I think, you know, this thing could be turned around very easily. Very easily. The report's very clear about what went wrong and what could be corrected.
They're not typically rectified by bringing the faculty member back or by firing the president.
Right. Yeah, we'd rather. I think we'd rather have the faculty member back. And that's, you know, but again, that the power to stop this thing now lies entirely in the hands of the administration. We have no power over this. We're just the bystanders, right? I think we can put pressure. I think we can do everything we can to get this situation rectified, and I hope we will. But we can't turn this thing around at this point. Yeah.
Okay. Now, this censure, how would students see this, or would they even see it?
Well, again, it would be in the press. I'm guessing even local press, the Chicago Tribune. I mean, all of these education reporters are going to be reporting on this. Those of us who've been working on this for a while have a list of press contacts who are waiting for the report. They know it's coming, and they're anxious to get a hold of it. So it will be pretty widely known around the city and then within the academic press. The student paper will probably cover this. You know, the Wizards will probably cover this. I mean, this is a big, this will be national news. Yeah. This is not good. Yeah.
The Board of Trustees would know about all of this and be
yes.
poised for receiving.
They have been well aware of this problem for a long time. Many will claim ignorance of it, just as our president will claim ignorance of these $144 million. There are documents that show that they've been aware of what's going on. And, of course, some of us in the room spoke to them very passionately about this problem a year ago. And, yes, they will be informed, even if not by the president. I am absolutely certain that several people in this room will go to a board meeting and inform them very directly.
The letter went to the chair of the Board of Trustees.
Yes. 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 The Illinois letter went to the Board of Trustees. The national letter only went as high as the president. So far. So if we want the board, that we want to be sure the board knows about it, we can certainly send it to them. But unless they just close their eyes and don't open the paper for a few weeks, they're going to know about it. And they'll be getting calls from the press, of course. Do you know about this? What's happening? But you would think that the president would make them aware. That would be good management, right? Make the board aware of what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, Craig?
Well, just a side note. Osceola, how do you pronounce his name?
Escoitia?
Escoitia, I'm sorry. Yeah, Escoitia. He is on the CPS board.
Yes, he is.
So he's very well for all of these austere budgets and for more.
Yeah.
The crowd. Yeah, I saw him at a school budget hearing and sitting on the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Board members are rarely on the side of the people, but unless it's in their interest to be. So that's what we hope. We hope that they will see that it is in their interest to correct this situation. Again, it doesn't take much to correct it. But any other questions about the censure process or what that means or... Okay, because our third speaker is here. Our second speaker is here.
Sorry, I just had a quick question.
Yes.
So this is about the tenure process or tenure status of one individual?
The heart of it is about one individual, but they did look at the wider context while they were here. We had a friendly AAUP sort of investigation a couple of years ago where an AAUP official was called in and asked to look at some of the issues on campus, and that report has been widely distributed about some of the problems. But this is typically how this goes, though, is that there's a problem, and usually it's one person, and usually it's a tenure problem that then goes through the process. Because as I'm sure many people here can attest, although this is one person's tenure, it's all of our working environment, and we're all feeling the pressures that brought that on boil of, you know, lack of respect for free speech, lack of respect for academic freedom, strange things happening in tenure processes and so forth, that I don't think that's foreign to anybody on this campus. But when it comes down to somebody losing their job, then it becomes a very serious issue. Yeah.
Well, and it's not, I mean, there's a very talented faculty member on campus who's been involved in a longstanding legal case with the university. And did the AAUP weigh in on that?
Yes.
That
the AAUP supported this unnamed faculty person in a with a legal defense fund grant and with an amicus brief in federal appeals court. So the AAUP has been involved in several very concerning issues. In that case, the university has taken the stance that because of this Garcetti decision, which is a very controversial one, the AUP has it all over their website, they can punish faculty members for anything that they say within the confines of their duties. And, of course, our duties are teaching, research, and service. And that just is in total contradiction to academic freedom. It's the exact opposite of that. Because to say, I can punish you if you say something in your class that I don't like, there's no academic freedom. I can punish you if you report, if you publish a piece of research I don't like. There's no academic freedom. I can punish you if you serve on a board that I don't like. That's not academic freedom. But that's not my view of the stance they've taken. That's the stance they've taken in filed legal documents, and that's why the AUP got involved in that.
Well, that's my point is now the university is getting into a pattern of getting alongside of the AUP.
Yeah. Which the president herself calls the gold standard. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is quite unpleasant. It's quite unpleasant. Yeah. Yes, Olivia. Yeah, he's going to speak next, actually. Let me put Russell up here, and then you can... So, Russell, if you want to tell us about shared governance. Russell Benjamin is the president of our Faculty Senate, for those of you who don't know him. And he's going to talk a little bit about shared governance generally. And if you don't mind being here, we're being recorded to be put on WZRD, so if you'll come here, they can get you on the microphone.
As Shirley Chisholm would say, I couldn't care less.
All right.
I want you.
Oh, hell.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. That's been a lifelong struggle for me. Shared governance is crazy. I have two major enemies inside the Faculty Senate. Their initials are Eric Hovenstein and Mark McKernan. So my basic problem with them has been that they have essentially insisted that the steering committee go against policies enunciated in the faculty constitution and in the faculty bylaws. And because I refuse to go along with that, I have called holy or unholy hell in the steering committee for the last 2 months. So, to get down to governance issues more specifically, since our esteemed colleague, Dr. Judy Kaplan Wanger, left the Faculty Senate chair position. The Senate has essentially let the administration take various measures that have been in contravention, that's a fancy word, to the Constitution and just principles of shared faculty governance. Now, in late September, the provost, Richard Heldobler, sent a message via email saying he wanted to meet with the faculty Senate Steering Committee. The Steering Committee is comprised of myself, the secretary, the vice chair, and two other faculty members of the Senate. And so at that meeting, I had assumed that he wanted to have us put him on the agenda to speak on October 1 when we met with him. What actually happened, though, was that he said he wanted to bounce something off of us. And what he told us was that he had decided to, or he was considering canceling the national search for the position of Director of Student Success and Retention, and that he was going to appoint someone who was already here at Northeastern. He said it was a money-saving move, and given our budget issues, that would be a positive thing. And after about 40 minutes, we asked him some questions. So the whole session lasted maybe 40 minutes. And so at the end of that, he left. And Senators McKernan and Hohenstein said that we needed to write a statement of endorsement of the provost's plan. And while I agreed that it sounded okay that a cost-cutting measure had been undertaken, I vehemently disagreed with the notion that the steering committee needed to endorse an action by the provost. And this was for two reasons. The first reason was that the steering committee is not empowered by the Constitution or by the bylaws to make endorsements. And the second is that when there are administrative hiring decisions, the president, as enunciated in the faculty constitution, is empowered to come to the Senate for consultation. I fought with my steering committee members for a week and a half, and I finally sent a letter, which is now part of the Senate file, to the provost on October 10th, saying that we thank you very much for having met with the steering committee, and you are certainly invited to come present your ideas to the entire faculty senate. That was on October 10th. I walked that letter over personally to the provost's office. That was a Friday afternoon. I think it was a Friday. In any case, it was a Thursday. And I took a physical copy over to Sabrina Guth, who works in faculty governance, and make sure that that statement went into the Senate file. This is a public university. Anybody can go over and look at that. I thought that was the end of it. But two things happened. One, other steering committee members drafted their own statement about 2 weeks after I had sent that letter. And also, they had requested that the names be removed from the letter I drafted to the provost. And so only my name appeared on it. I could not speak on behalf of the steering committee. I just said that, sincerely yours, Russell Benjamin, chair of the faculty senate. So around October the 22nd, I believe, there were other members of the steering committee who drafted their own statement that went to the provost via email that said that essentially that they supported the provost's proposal. I found that quite disturbing. And admittedly, I had not looked at my email, so apparently they had sent a statement to me a couple days earlier saying, I'm sure you won't put your name on this, but this is what we're going to send to the provost, which they did. So I found out that they had done it a couple days after they had sent it out. And so it was at that point that I drafted an extensive email to the faculty senate as a whole, attached a copy of my letter to the provost to that, and sent it to the senate, trying to be, by relative standards, according to myself and the standards I've set, trying to be non-confrontational, I did not put anything in that email about what the steering committee had done. What I had said basically was that, because in the meantime, we should also remember, the provost sent out an email saying that after consultation with the steering committee and the dean's council, I am pleased to announce the hiring of a person for the position I just described. That's what happened. And so the email I sent to the Senate said that, one, there was no official consultation because of what I just said. A consultation has to take place with the entire faculty senate, not by a segment thereof. Two, the faculty senate is not empowered to make endorsements. Now, there is a caveat to this. Okay? The steering committee. The steering committee's basic duty is to set the agenda for upcoming meetings. And we're required to meet with the president once a semester. The steering committee's duties are spelled out in detail in the Senate bylaws. And in the faculty constitution, there are aspects of the steering committee that are spelled out in different places. Now, in regard to endorsements and consultations, there is an exception that's allowed. And that exception is that under emergency circumstances or during the summer, the steering committee can meet with the provost, well, can meet with the president and can issue, recommendations. The meeting that the provost had with us took place on October 1. During the school year, 1 week before the Senate had its regular meeting, okay? After I sent out this email to the Senate, so that day I had a steering committee meeting. And so I got an email from Senator McKernan that said that we needed to have a discussion about whether or not the steering committee could do endorsements. My email that I sent back said I have no interest in such a conversation. I mean, basically, you might as well ask me to shop at Walmart. So to me, it was pretty clear that there was no constitutional or bylaws basis for a letter of endorsements. And the provost himself never asked for a letter of endorsement. So that's a part that I also found interesting in regard to this whole episode. So we go to the Faculty Senate Steering Committee meeting on that Tuesday, I think it was October the 29th, somewhere around there. And we got the agenda done in about 30 minutes. And at the end, one of the steering committee members said that they wanted to have the email that they had sent to the provost entered into the Senate file. At first, I was taken aback, but then I thought, this means that these other members want to put into the Senate files a statement that documents they're going against the Constitution and the bylaws. So I said, okay. Now, we had a Senate meeting this past Tuesday, and I had intended to have this address that wound up not happening for a variety of reasons. And so it is my plan, because other members of the steering committee want this to be talked about, inside the Senate itself. So we haven't formally made the agenda yet, but that is something that I intend to have on there. I don't have a whole lot to say about that beyond what I've said. I mean, my basic thing is that at all times, I believe that the faculty senate, its committees and subcommittees need to abide by the Constitution and the bylaws. Now, there's another matter regarding governance. As some of you may know, the Committee on General Education has been somewhat involved in this plan to, revamp the general education core curriculum. And I had somewhat gotten confused because I thought that the people who were, you know, spearheading this, for that's kind of a stereotypical term, but the people who were taking the lead on this were members of the Committee on General Education, but they turned out to be people who were from the General Education Task Force, which is an arm of the administration. So at Tuesday's meeting, they gave a presentation wherein they talked about how they wanted to have the general education core curriculum revamped to include 300-level courses, but also they talked about the fact that the administration's plan was to have the General Education Committee absorbed into a new body, and that half of the people on this new body would be appointed by the administration. Now, I can promise you that as long as there's breath in this 50-year-old body, if I'm the only senator to do so, I will oppose any move by the Senate to endorse such a plan. I think it is a Godzilla-sized mistake. The administration is already more powerful than the faculty, staff, and students on this campus, and I do not believe that there is any upside to having people who are essentially helping to set the curriculum here appointed by the provost. Also, what I found disturbing was that one of our senators at the meeting, who I will not name that person at this moment, had asked whether or not, because they had a list of different goals and proficiencies that should be demonstrated by students with this new core for general education. And the question that came up was, well, I don't see race and ethnicity, racial and ethnic diversity, the issue of students getting to know more about different racial and ethnic groups, you know, listed among the goals of this new curriculum on general education. And the person, there were actually two at one point, but there was one person left representing the task force at this point. And the person had no real answer, which gets at another point. And that point is this. As much as we talk about diversity on this campus, the diversity at this campus is primarily among the workers at the lower level. And I don't mean lower level in a denigrating way, but I mean in terms of prestige, pay, and official position. We see the diversity among our students, which is why I've stayed in this icebox of a town for 16 years. You can walk into a classroom and see the United Nations represented, basically. And I think that's just unbelievably fantastic. But when you start talking about the faculty members who are tenure track, then tenured, then full professors, it gets less and less diverse. It's very white. Oh, I will come to them in a second. And it's very white. And I don't say that to denigrate white Americans. I don't hate white people, in spite of what people have said to me or about me over the years. But there is something askew about the fact that we are a Hispanic-serving institution and we are a campus of color in regard to the students, the people who keep this place clean, who cook for us, and who take care of the grounds. There's a stark contrast between that diversity and the diversity that we see when we start going up into the faculty ranks. And at the administration, I was just at the Board of Trustees meeting. And so, as you may know now, we have a constituency table. So that there are four constituencies here at Northeastern. One of them is administration. What it's like A&P, civil service, the faculty senate, and planning and something. Sorry, I don't mean to slight those other constituencies at all. And so we sit there on the side, and from that vantage point, I can look across the room past the Board of Trustees table. And at the table where they are the vice presidents, we have like one person of color at that table among the vice presidents. We have some folk of color who are like assistant or associate administrators, but as far as I can tell, they don't have major powers on this campus. And I frankly believe that that plays a role in some of what we've seen on this campus. The other thing that I think is going on is that we basically have a very top-down, increasingly business-oriented administration. At the Board of Trustees meeting that I just left, the provost and others working under him were talking about the recruitment plans for Northeastern. And here's some of the terms that were used. High school territory management, expanded name purchases, innovation and collaboration, high touch recruitment, and customer relationship management. Throughout the provost administration, he consistently talked about increasing the yield.
You were shopping at Walmart.
I haven't been inside a Walmart in maybe 4 years. It's after I had suffered a family loss, and I went there with a friend of mine, but I didn't buy anything. I've not bought a stick of chewing gum from Walmart since 1996. But to hear terms like yield for students, I'm like, ooh, it just sounds like such commodification of human beings. And I found that very disturbing. Also, you may be interested to know that there's a customer relationship management, and part of that means that there's going to be tracking of people who, make inquiries about Northeastern. So they're trying to track the potential students through the use of the, of technology. So students who look at different sites and stuff related to Northeastern, they're going to keep track of them so they can trail them and try to recruit them. And so, I mean, now that's above my pay scale how that's actually done nuts and bolts like, but I kept thinking about some of the revelations that we've seen in the national news over the past several months. Okay, so I know it's after 4 o'clock, people have classes, so I will stop there. But I anticipate that there is going to be a several month period of governance struggles. I would like to have, in regard to these plans, to have the Committee on General Education revamped. I would like to hear at the Senate from the Committee on Education, and I would like to also hear from FACAC. And so I will be working to try to make that happen. Thank you.